When cancer strikes, we tend to review our lifestyle choices.
I've always been active. I thought I was doing everything right. Ate well. I'm vegetarian for many, many years. Participate in triathlon.
But a new study claims cancer risk is mostly random. What's the fallout? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
So here's this population that never gets studied, responding dramatically at high rates very, very quickly.
We wanted to actually measure exactly what was going on in the
brains
light.
Are complex systems of connections modulated by connections.
You are the only person in history of mankind.
And he used Lego Mindstorms to build something
called
like
a digestion.
Constantly refreshing the screen, looking at
it. Ignore chemical ones that open up and scare you out of it.
Dr. Harris, room 9 now, please.
On today's show, what's art got to do with math? STEM education becomes STEAM with an A for art. Also, STEAM as in hot, wet air, as a magical healing tonic. And speaking of that kind of thing, exaggerated claims in science reporting. Who's to blame? But first up, we hear about cancer risks all the time. Smoking, of course, terrible diets, alcohol vices, and of course, your family history. But what if a big part of getting cancer was just chance, random genetic mistakes, or mutations gone wrong? In a new article published in the journal Science, Christian Tomasetti and Bert Vogelstein of Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine argue that random mutations may account for 2/3 of the risk for many cancer types. Their work was widely covered in the media, with most of the headlines reading along the lines of, cancer is just bad luck.
New research suggests the majority of adult cancer cases are caused by bad luck.
A new study on dozens of different cancers linking just a fraction of them to bad genes or unhealthy lifestyles, with scientists concluding that most of them are simply the result of bad luck. Laura Engel has more.
There's nothing you can do about this, right? I mean, this is random.
No. It's time to show you some of this morning's headlines. The Wall Street Journal says the risk for most types of cancer can be blamed on bad luck, not genetics or lifestyle.
So what does all of this mean for our healthy cancer prevention habits? Joining us now is a man who has made living healthy his career, physician and former Philadelphia Health Commissioner Don Schwartz. He's now with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Don, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
What did you think of the article? What was your first reaction reading it?
Well, I was in a funny way surprised that I was consulted, because I read an article about this first in the New York Times, which suggested that this is going to revolutionize in some way how we think about prevention of cancer. And having read the article, I have to say not much really changes. And for the average American, hopefully virtually nothing changes. This is an article that looked at what proportion of 31 particular cancers could be said to be caused by environmental or genetic factors, rather than the cancer happening what's called spontaneously, which means just a fluke of nature in a sense, or as they say, random chance. And I think in medicine and healthcare, we've known forever that a substantial number of people who get cancer have cancer because as cells have divided, an accident has occurred. What we don't understand about that process is cells divide every day. And why certain cell divisions become ones that lead to cancer and others don't, we don't understand. But what the article also says is that in another number of cancers, the environment and heredity make a big difference. And in fact, through statistical processes, they're able to say which cancers should have large environmental effects. And the good news is they're the ones that we have now for years said to people have environmental and hereditary effects.
Such as
lung cancer and smoking. So there we have, I think, a really good model for how an environmental factor, that is smoking, can be changed and can make a big difference to people's risk of lung cancer. Another is basal cell cancer of the skin, which we know and have known is related to sun exposure. So I don't think this article changes the recommendations that anybody's doctor is going to give to them, and it shouldn't change behavior in this country.
The reason we wanted to talk to you is because you're somebody who has dedicated their whole career to changing habits, to introducing healthy habits. And when you read the headlines, it says cancer is just bum luck. Or to many people, that's going to be the takeaway point. So what about that?
Well, I think there's a sad point that even in scientific journals, there's a piece of marketing. And it's to the journal's benefit to get people to read articles. And this is not a bad article. In fact, it's an important article in pointing out that we need to be vigilant in terms of screening, because for a number of types of cancer, we likely are never going to have good prevention, at least under our current thinking about prevention. But it also reinforces that for a lot of cancers, and a lot of cancers that cause high rates of death in this country, what we're doing is the right thing, telling people to prevent those cancers by changing the environments around them is important. And knowing that for certain families, there are cancers that will run in families is an important message. But I think for a very long time, people have wondered when they've gotten cancer if they've done something wrong, if for their particular kind of cancer. So the article highlights, for instance, cancer of the small intestine. People have wondered if they've eaten something wrong, or they've lived somehow wrong, or if their children have to worry. What this article says is that for that particular kind of cancer, the environmental and genetic risks are small. It just happens to happen.
Are you worried, though, that most people won't read even the whole article, let alone the study? So they'll see a headline that basically seems to suggest doesn't matter what you do. So does that bum you out as a public health guy when that seems to be the big message?
So what I've learned over time is people are pretty smart. And even with headlines, people usually can figure out at least over time what the real message is. And fortunately now, we have better access to healthcare in this country than we've ever had before. So people should have providers, healthcare providers, who can help them understand what studies like this say, and more importantly, can help them know if the pain or ache or concern that they have is related to cancer and get diagnosed early. People need to be appropriately using healthcare and going for primary care and taking care of themselves.
Do you ever get frustrated at the messaging that seems to undermine your work? You know, we're all day, we're bombarded with messaging. You know, this study probably plays a very minor role, but we're bombarded with messaging that tells us, go ahead, go eat this thing, go do this, go drink this.
I think I've worked hard to understand why that messaging exists, that there's a market and there's human behavior. And we know, for instance, around salt, for instance, that when exposed to lots of salt, people get used to the taste of salt and want more.
Oh, yes.
So you may know in Philadelphia that there's an initiative working with Chinese takeout restaurants where by making the people who cook in Chinese takeout restaurants aware of the problems of putting lots of salt into Chinese takeout food, there was a voluntary 20% reduction in sodium content in Chinese takeout in the city of Philadelphia. And that 20% reduction in salt in Chinese takeout food, as we understand it, hasn't been noticed by anybody. So we've been able to change the environment for people that promotes better heart health for lots of people who still have Chinese takeout many days for lunch. So they're healthier. They don't necessarily know why they're healthier, but we're promoting their health by changing the environment.
Don, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
Don Schwartz is a physician and a director at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And this disclaimer, the foundation is a supporter of WHYY. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. This month, Pennsylvania joined the ranks of more than two dozen other states in expanding Medicaid. Alana Gordon has the details.
State officials estimate that as of January 1st, about 600,000 Pennsylvanians became eligible for Medicaid. It's a big deal for people like Marcin Ellis Hartfield, a 45-year-old home health worker in Philadelphia who helps people with basic tasks like bathing, dressing, and feeding.
We have to stay healthy ourselves, and if we're not healthy, then, you know, then they can't stay healthy because we can't take care of them.
Ellis Hartfield earns about $9 an hour and is the primary breadwinner for her family of three. But before this new Medicaid option, she fell into a coverage gap. She made too much to qualify for Medicaid, but she didn't make enough to qualify for discounts buying private insurance. She and her husband remained uninsured and postponed regular checkups. At one point, her husband went to the ER in a lot of pain and left with more than $1,000 in medical bills.
He was supposed to get a procedure done, but he, being as though we didn't have health insurance, he was like, forget it because we can't pay it out of pocket. But this is
letter of approval. Underneath the stack of those ER bills, Ellis Hartfield pulls out a letter that she and her husband recently received, confirming they're now enrolled in Medicaid in Pennsylvania, thanks to those eligibility changes that took effect January 1st.
I'm going to tell them, look, now you got it. Now all that stuff you was crying about, now you can get it done, you know, because he needs it.
Starting last January, states began tapping into federal funding to expand the number of people eligible for Medicaid by broadening the income guidelines to just above the poverty line. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett, a Republican, waited until this year to do that so he could get federal permission to make some changes. He didn't get approval for everything, like a controversial job training requirement, but benefits have changed for some enrollees, and in 2016, some will start paying premiums.
Pennsylvania was really the last state in its region to move ahead with expanding coverage to those in the coverage gap.
Joan Alker is a Medicaid expert at Georgetown University. She says Pennsylvania is now one of 28 states to expand Medicaid.
New Jersey with Governor Christie had already moved ahead, and Delaware and Maryland.
Alker says 16 states, all Republican, are either not doing anything or considering their own alternative proposal. Pennsylvania's incoming governor, Tom Wolf, a Democrat, has said he plans to scrap Corbett's changes and move forward with a traditional expansion. Alker says even so, Corbett's proposal is sure to influence other states who may be considering an alternative. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
In his first term in office, Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter set a lofty goal. He wanted Philadelphia to become the greenest city in America by 2015. Nutter and the Office of Sustainability he created wrote a plan called GreenWorks Philadelphia that named 14 energy and environmental targets to meet by this year. Now that 2015 is upon us, Carolyn Beeler went to find out if that greenest city promise in fact came true.
The short answer is no. There's no national ranking of greenness, no repeated, reliable report that compares how different cities stack up on sustainability. There are hundreds of possible factors to be measured, thousands of different ways to crunch the numbers.
We think that there are a lot of cities that are doing great work, that have seen progress in a number of areas.
That's Philadelphia's sustainability director, Catherine Gajewski.
So we certainly think that we're at the top of the pack, but to say definitively is hard to say.
What surprised me is how many national experts outside of Philly actually agreed with Gajewski. Naming a number one may be impossible, but Philly's at least at the table. Cliff Majerzik is head of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Market Transformation, which advocates for energy efficiency in buildings.
Traditionally, people wouldn't have thought of Philadelphia as one of the greenest cities in the country. You would have traditionally thought of a city like Portland or Seattle. But I think that under Mayor Nutter's leadership, Philadelphia is becoming one of the greenest cities in the country.
Many Philadelphians see their city as an old East Coast industrial hub with brownfields, a large refinery, and sidewalks so cluttered with litter they earned the city the nickname Philadelphia. But Majerzik says looks can be deceiving. Philadelphia is one of the first cities to require building owners to report energy usage, a measure designed to drive investment in efficiency.
So many of the things that make a city green or not green are not immediately visible. You can look at a building and you can't tell just from looking at it whether it's an energy hog or a highly efficient building. Similarly, you know, the sewage and stormwater improvements that have been made, to an untrained eye, you wouldn't even notice.
Those sewage and stormwater improvements you mentioned are the crown jewel of the city's sustainability portfolio, touted by Penn professor and author of the GreenWorks plan, Mark Allen Hughes.
The main genius of Philadelphia's approach to stormwater management is that it completely changes what the definition of the problem is.
Instead of framing the problem as how to treat more rainwater running off of roads, which would be fixed by adding more pipes and stormwater treatment facilities, the city is now preventing runoff in the first place. It's doing that with new porous pavement, rain barrels, and other green infrastructure. Philly still lags behind West Coast sustainability darlings in green city rankings, but Hughes argues that's more a matter of public opinion than actual policy.
One of the things that tends to happen with the rankings is that we conflate sustainability with hipsterism.
Philly may be behind the West Coast on DIY hipster cred.
But in terms of all of these kinds of fundamentals, Philadelphia is actually totally showing up.
Philly ranked 13th out of 27 major U.S. and Canadian cities in 2011 in the most comprehensive green city index I could find. For a more recent snapshot, I picked a random cross-section of sustainability metrics. First, literal green space. Philadelphia is 13% parkland, which puts it in the top third of the 100 most populous cities. Second, greenhouse gas emissions. Cliff Majerzyk again.
Philadelphia had the fourth lowest greenhouse gas emissions per capita of the 14 cities that are profiled in the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy 2013 scorecard.
Third, transport. About 36% of Philadelphians bike, walk, or ride public transit to work. That's the fifth highest rate in the 60 biggest cities. On Tuesday morning, with the first real snow of the season making streets slick, there were still bikers gingerly pedaling down Spruce Street, where a buffered bike lane was added in 2009. Marie Brown stopped at the intersection of 15th Street by dragging her feet on the ground.
Yeah, in the snow, I just kind of don't trust my brakes totally, so I always kind of like put my feet down. Yeah.
It's like the Fred Flintstone stop.
Yeah, totally, totally. It looks dumb, but I don't care, you know?
The number of bike commuters like Brown increased by 51% during Nutter's tenure. Finally, a fourth sustainability metric, recycling rates. Philadelphia reports half of municipal solid waste is recycled, higher than the national average of about 35%, but lower than cities including San Diego, Seattle, and Portland. Though none of these stats put Philly at the head of the pack, Mayor Michael Nutter argues he's met his green city goal.
We think so.
Nutter points out that work on 160 of 164 initiatives in the GreenWorks plan is underway or complete. Whether or not Philly ever earns the mantle of greenest city, Nutter says landing near the top on any sustainability metric is a big step forward.
Prior to my announcing that this is the direction that we wanted to move in, had we not done many of the things that we said we were going to do and have done, you and I probably wouldn't be having this conversation because we probably weren't in the top five or the top 15.
In recent years, Philadelphia's relatively limited public transport networks, high water leakage rates, and low numbers of LEED-certified buildings have garnered criticism. Looking ahead, the Clean Air Council's Joseph Minot worries Philly's goal of becoming a center of natural gas processing will wear away at its thin green patina.
I would say that becoming a fossil fuel energy hub is inconsistent with being a truly green city.
Today, he says, the city is at a crossroads.
We've made some really revolutionary positive changes. And it seems to me right now we have a choice. Do we want to continue down that path of sustainability, or do we just want to sort of put all our eggs in one basket and become a hub of essentially dirty fuel?
Nutter is pushing for the jobs that becoming an energy hub would bring. But someone else will stand in his place at the crossroads next year when a new mayor takes office. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Coming up on The Pulse, V96.15XA. What am I talking about? I'm talking in code, medical billing code, that is. That whole system is about to get a makeover in an attempt to capture all of life's mishaps.
Well, there are certainly a handful of codes that are considered ridiculous. One of the most famous ones is burned due to water skis on fire.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. For every sore throat and suture, every embarrassing rash and broken toe, there's a code. A 3-to-5-digit billing code that allows doctors and hospitals to communicate with insurance companies and get paid. This information is the lifeblood of the U.S. healthcare system, and in just a few months, the codes are getting a reboot. Todd Bookman has the story.
Right now, according to the code set, there's 14,567 different ways Americans get sick or hurt themselves. Add to that another 4,000 or so procedure codes. They represent what the doctor or nurse does to treat you. So that's about 18,000 entries. On October 1st of this year, that number increases nearly eightfold.
In this case, bigger is better, much like if you remember phone books, which we don't use much anymore. A bigger phone book contains more phone numbers, and therefore it's more likely to contain the number that you need, that you're looking for.
Dr. Evan Gwilliam runs the website Find a Code, which lets coding professionals search for the right entry based on keywords. He also travels the country training people on the new system. Gwilliam says the driving force behind the expansion is better information. Medicine has obviously changed since 1979, when the current code set called ICD-9 was implemented. And the new codes attempt to capture those advancements. Plus, public health researchers want to know more about how and where people get hurt. And that's led to some very weird new codes in ICD-10.
Well, there are certainly a handful of codes that are considered ridiculous. One of the most famous ones is burn due to water skis on fire. And so the creators of the code set wanted there to be codes to describe any possible circumstance where someone could be injured. And they've done it, because water ski fires don't occur that often, but theoretically it could. Therefore, there's a code to cover that scenario.
There's a code for being bit by a turtle, another for being struck by one. Did your hang glider explode? That's V96.15XA. If it only caught on fire but didn't explode, use 14XA. These are good icebreakers during day-long ICD-10 training seminars, of which Shiny George has sat through her fair share. She's Senior Director of Health Information Management at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, and she's a cheerleader for coding professionals who do the heavy lifting of translating doctors' notes into numbers.
This is the closest you can come to medicine without being a doctor. Getting your hands dirty, you read medical records, you translate those diagnoses and procedures and do codes, and you get it. You can talk to a physician in the medical language.
George and her team became fluent in ICD-10 3 years ago, but the federal government delayed the transition. So to stay fresh, coders have been recording both the new and old versions. She says Jefferson is ready.
Bring it on. We are. We've invested significant amount of time, resources, money, sweat and tears. But we are ready for October 1st, 2015.
Of course, not everyone shares that enthusiasm. Many doctors' groups, including the American Medical Association, worry about the costs of switching to ICD-10. An industry-funded study put the price tag for a large practice at up to $8 million, though coding groups say that's way, way overblown. Along with software and training, another possible expense is delayed reimbursement from insurers and Medicare and Medicaid, because there's bound to be glitches when the system switches over. William Harvey, a rheumatologist at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, says that will hurt small medical providers.
For better or worse, healthcare is a business just like any other, and there are not many businesses who could withstand 3-month interruptions in their cash flow and still operate.
On top of that, doctors are being asked to absorb a huge amount of other changes in how they work, from electronic health records to so-called accountable care. For their part, Independence Blue Cross says it's expecting a smooth transition come October 1st and that there won't be anything close to a 3-month delay in reimbursing doctors. Joan Jennerjohn is managing the process. She offers this analysis.
If you think of any significant changes that you need to make, even in your personal life, there's always that fear of crossing that threshold. I think there's a fear of going from something that's been very familiar and in place for over 30 years to something that's new.
She thinks all those new categories will help the health system do a better job measuring quality of care, not just the quantity. Evan Gwilliam from findacode.com agrees with that take.
It will do a better job of tracking information. It'll provide data that we can use to improve our healthcare system. And in the long term, it may even save money as we become more efficient, even though the short term is going to be a little difficult.
Those short term challenges, small or huge, depending who you ask, could be enough to persuade lawmakers into another delay. There's talk of Congress slipping language into legislation this spring. The official record on hang glider explosions may just have to wait. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Here are some science news headlines I just read earlier. Trans fat may hurt your memory. Genes may help identify children with future psychological problems. Gastric bypass may save lives over time. Why tilapia is worse for you than bacon. We often hear that science reporting exaggerates findings, but who's to blame? Joining us now is regular Pulse contributor SciCurious, Bethany Brookshire. She is a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. You just wrote about the path to exaggeration in science reporting. Where does it start?
What I was writing about when I wrote a piece is actually a new article that has come out recently analyzing 462 press releases of biomedical studies performed in the United Kingdom and reported in 11 different United Kingdom news outlets. And they were looking at where exactly exaggeration enters into the press cycle. Is it the fault of all those shady journalists, you know, walking in, looking at a scientific study and going, aha, whales can cure cancer? Or is it, you know, the shady scientists, you know, going, haha, my simple findings on genetics, I am going to immediately relate to curing cancer? You know, whose fault is it? And the answer is, at some level, it is everyone's, and no one gets a pass.
And did the study find that press releases do, in fact, exaggerate the findings a bit?
Some of them do, yes. So they found that 40% of press releases contained explicit advice not indicated in the scientific journal article. So explicit advice would be things like stop eating eggs, tilapia is worse than bacon, things like that. About 33% of the claims in press releases used stronger language than in the journal article, which is something we call conflating correlation with causation. For example, there might be a correlation between, you know, high levels of stress and occurrence of hemorrhoids. But this does not necessarily mean that stress causes hemorrhoids. And finally, 36% of press releases inferred a finding related to human health when the study was not actually performed in humans.
And a lot of reporters are also not dedicated health and science reporters. So I guess a lot of them just don't have the training to see when a claim is exaggerated.
That's very true, especially with regard to things like statistics. I mean, I can look at some studies and I can say, hey, a one-tailed t-test and you barely got a p of 0.05? But if you're using really complicated statistics, I'll admit I'm just trusting you. And so that's where journalists really do have to rely on trusted outside commenters.
And I guess as reporters, we sometimes use words like could, may, or potentially, and somehow that makes it all okay because we didn't say it does cause cancer. We just say it could.
Well, and you know, anything could happen. Unicorns could exist. But, you know, it is important to keep an eye on that kind of language. And, you know, the reality is no one gets a pass. But in the end, I think that we as writers, as people who convey science to the public, in a way, the buck stops with us, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's our job to determine what is newsworthy. You know, what gets out there to the media and to report it responsibly, to get that outside comment, to check our facts.
And what's your advice to consumers of science news? How do we detect something that's perhaps not as stated?
I would say if you see an article and it looks too good to be true, find another article. Look, you know, if something's getting a lot of media coverage, there may be well more than 3 or 4 outlets writing about it. Do they all say the same thing? What do they say? It's worth looking that stuff up.
Bethany, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab. Our next story is about a basic, essential skill in medicine. Physicians in training practice it up to 500 times before they really master it. Tanya English reports.
When the doctor places that cold stethoscope on your chest, she's listening for 2 distinct sounds.
Lub-dub, lub-dub, lub-dub. You can almost set your clock to what you're hearing. They are clear, they are crisp, and they are regular.
Marianne Kuzma teaches the science of hearing heart sounds at Drexel University College of Medicine. That skill is called auscultation.
So you can auscultate the heart, you can auscultate the lungs, you can auscultate the abdomen. It's just using the stethoscope to hear something.
The heart pumps oxygen-rich blood to the rest of the body.
Brain, kidney, muscles are supplied by the left side of the heart.
As the heart muscle fills and relaxes, blood flows through the chambers, and valves keep the blood flowing in the right direction.
So think about the garden hose. You've got a big fat hose that you're trying to squeeze the water through, no problem.
So the lub sound is one valve closing, and the dub sound is a different valve shutting off. But if a valve is unhealthy, say it's thick or calcified, it doesn't close properly. It's kind of like pinching off that garden hose.
It's going to have higher pressures and you're going to have higher sounds.
Medical students train to hear those changes as a clue to heart trouble.
Listen to a fourth heart sound. I will begin with 3 normal beats and then add the fourth heart sound.
There's an extra sound that interrupts the usual cadence.
It sounds like a stone skipping, a blum-blum, blum-blum, duh. And so that is, we often say that's similar to the word Tennessee, where if you think about the first 2 syllables of Tennessee, we roll them together, tenna, and that's what you're hearing. As you're listening to the sound, think of the word Tennessee.
It's all about pattern recognition and proper stethoscope placement.
So underneath your second rib on your right side, it's about right here. You feel where I'm pointing to? A little lower than your collarbone. And then you go to your left side.
25-year-old medical student Angelica Johnson is finally getting to see patients after 2 years of book work.
So you always do a cardiac exam, no matter what. That's just something that just occurs. You could tell me that your toe hurts. I'm going to listen to your heart.
The 3rd-year student learned her technique by listening to heart sounds and training exercises on her commute from West Philly.
Next stop, 38th Street.
So I would download it and just listen to it on the Septoride to school. Keep repeating and repeating and repeating it.
Drexel professors say it can take up to 500 repetitions before students can consistently identify the whooshes and murmurs that suggest a problem. To practice, Johnson also paints pictures of the sounds in her mind, one murmur called an aortic stenosis. Slowly gets louder, comes to a peak, then slowly gets softer.
So it goes up and then it comes down. It's like a diamond-shaped murmur.
Another third year, Matthew Diamond, he says for him, it helps to tap the rhythm with his fingers as he listens to the simulated heartbeats.
Love, dub, dub, or love, love, dub.
It's trickier to notice those sounds in a breathing, squirming person, but dedication pays off. A patient came in for a regular checkup. Diamond heard a strange muffle and sent the patient for an ultrasound.
And it turns out that that patient had massive PEs, which are pulmonary embolisms, so like blood clots in the heart, blockages in the blood vessels that supply your lungs. It's just a very dangerous situation.
Nice save.
Yeah, thank you.
Students also practice their skills at Drexel's Simulation Center. There, technician Diana Alberti operates a high-tech dummy called Simman.
I don't feel well.
The mannequin, I mean, it's kind of awkward looking, and everyone gets frightened by the first time that it blinks.
Alberti can program Simman to have all sorts of heart problems.
Oh, I can't breathe and my chest hurts. Help.
If the students are feeling the pulse, it picks up on that and records it, things like that.
The mannequin knows when it's being touched?
Yes, it's wireless, and it has a ton of different sensors that can track different things.
Newbies like first-year student Mazier Shakari can poke and prod around without worrying about hurting a real person. It's his very first time in the sim lab, and he just recently learned how to wear his stethoscope correctly.
I kept putting it on backwards.
He's got it on right now and leans over to listen to the mannequin's chest.
So I definitely hear something that's not normal. And so instead of hearing that strong dub, you actually hear kind of like a whoosh sound.
Final answer.
Final answer. I would say possibly a...
No one's grading you.
I know, I'm not. Exactly. I'd say possibly mitral regurge. I'm not entirely sure.
Actually, it's a mitral stenosis. Technician Diana Alberti says he heard the problem at the right spot, but not the right kind of abnormality.
You look like you're a little embarrassed that you got it wrong, but you're able to hear the difference. This is, I would consider, a success for you.
Which is to say, at first, it's hard to hear clearly. Here's another hint from Alberti.
When you're trying to build your skills in being able to hear and identify different heart sounds, it helps to, when you're just listening to music, to try and pick out the different instruments, and specifically the bass. So it's that background noise that often gets tucked behind the drums or the guitar. And when you can pick that out easily, it kind of helps. It correlates to your ability to pick out that faint sound against all the other noises in a room and inside the body when you're listening to the heart.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Coming up on The Pulse, hot stuff. Very hot. Steamy.
I love hot. It detoxes you. Like it opens everything up.
I mean, I have a cold, so it was like the first thing I wanted to do was come in here, and you feel like you're just sweating it out.
The healing powers of steam. Truth or just a bunch of hot air? Sorry, I had to do that. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. What's the best part, or perhaps the only good part, of going to the gym? Sitting in the steam room, of course. It's hot, it's comfortable, you can stretch out, and you don't even have to really see any other person sitting next to you. Some people believe that being in that hot room is almost magical. It can do anything from detoxifying the body to curing the common cold. Jeanette Woods went to test out the healing powers of heat.
There's an old Russian saying that goes,
"The day you steam is the day you don't age."
That's Brian McWilliams. He's gathered with a group of friends at Southampton Spa, a Russian-style banya, or bathhouse, outside of Philadelphia. The group call themselves the Philly Steamers, and several times a month they sit in a wood-paneled room that's heated by an oven to temperatures that sometimes pass boiling. And they say it makes them feel great.
200 degrees is a lot more tolerable than one would think, even though sometimes it can be close to the temperature at which water boils.
Tolerable is relative. On the day I visited the banya, it was 197 degrees. I lasted for about 30 seconds before I bolted for the door. I've never been that hot. My fingers are burning. The tips of my fingers are burning. Okay, I managed to go back, but wondered how anyone could stand this kind of temperature.
I love hot. So, I know, it's good. But it detoxes you. Like, it opens everything up.
Like I said, I mean, I have a cold, so it was like the first thing I wanted to do was come in here, and you feel like you're just sweating it out. But, I mean, it does feel like you're just kind of, like, wringing the body out.
Tracy and Chris are firm believers in the healing powers of steam and expect to leave the banya feeling better. Brian McWilliams agrees.
Like, if you feel a cold coming on, like, and you go to the banya right away, it'll knock it out before it starts. You know, Russians have a whole tradition of that. They also sometimes drink vodka, but that's not necessary.
There's no evidence to say that being in a sauna or steam room is going to make you get rid of your virus or your flu or your cold any faster than if you were just to use, standard means of taking medications and drinking plenty of fluids and resting.
Robert Sinzilla is chief of emergency medicine at Einstein Hospital in East Norton, Pennsylvania, in Montgomery County. Dr. Sinzilla throws cold water on the overall body detox theory, too.
I can't say that there's any benefit from removing toxins or other harmful substances that are potentially within the body.
But on the plus side,
it allows pores on your body to open so that you're able to get rid of some of the wastes that might be in your skin.
Which is why steam is often used in facials. Steamy heat is not medicine. But the thing that keeps Philly Steamers coming back is how it makes you feel.
From both a personal and professional standpoint, I think that the element of heat, when it's used in a safe fashion, just tends to make people feel more comfortable.
If your nose is stuffy, steam won't kill the virus causing the cold, but the moist heat will help loosen the congestion. Inhaling it can help a chest cold for the same reasons. The heat also relaxes tension in muscles throughout the body, so you feel more limber, less achy.
I don't have necessarily enough time to devote to, say, going to yoga or something to lengthen my muscles and to relax and elongate. So for me to come here, it's really good for my body. And I leave here feeling 4 inches taller.
Susan is a fitness instructor and devoted steamer. But much of the pleasure she derives from the banya is social.
So I come with my husband and my 3 sons, and occasionally they'll bring a friend. And I come with my brother and his wife and his 2 sons. And we just make a morning and early afternoon of it, and we just celebrate each other. And we come in here, and Brian makes a beautiful experience for us, and it just feels incredible.
But there are limits.
How hot is it in here?
190s.
Yeah, really.
Probably mid-190s.
We would all die if we had to live here.
My feet are sweating. After steaming for about 15 minutes, it's time for cooling off. The steamers head for the plunge pool and cold showers outside the banya.
The cold is good. Stand under it. Woo! It cools your head off, so your temperature drops immediately.
And as soon as they cool off, they head back in for more heat.
So it's like steam, rinse, repeat.
Yeah, it is. It's a process, and it's a yin and yang.
For The Pulse, I'm Jeanette Woods.
And now we're going to talk about a different kind of STEAM. If you start with an education focused on science, technology, engineering, and math, you have STEM. When you add art, you get STEAM. The idea is to use art to teach math and math to teach art. But in practice, it's not so clean cut. For almost 10 years, artist Ben Volta has been going into Philadelphia schools not to teach art per se, nor science, but to create projects that draw from both. Reporter Peter Crimmins tagged along with Volta to better understand his teaching method.
A few weeks ago, Ben Volta and his crew of painters put the final touches on a mural that wraps around the outside wall of the McMichael School in the Mantua neighborhood of West Philadelphia. It starts on the south wall of the school with images of molecules and cells, and they become plants as the mural moves east, and then it turns the corner into imagery of outer space and orbital paths. It's called Micro to Macro. Volta arrived at McMichael a year ago. He had no ideas, no lesson plan, and no vision of the final product. He came on the first day of class, sat down, and listened to the teacher.
I remember them doing a lot of long division and remembering how much I don't remember how to do that and trying to figure it out as they go.
As a kid, Volta was a terrible student, and really, he doesn't know that much about science. While not paying attention to the lesson in long division, he remembered seeing a short film called The Powers of Ten. It was made in 1977 for IBM by Ray and Charles Eames, famous for the Eames chair. It's a visual experiment in exponential multiplication. It starts with a zoom out, focusing on two people picnicking in a park, and then expands exponentially to the outer reaches of the universe. Volta showed the class this movie.
Now, every 10 seconds, we will look from 10 times farther away, and our field of view will be 10 times wider.
And then the camera zooms back in by the same powers of 10, coming closer and closer back to Earth, back to the people in the park, and then probing into their cell structure. Kia Smith, now in 8th grade, remembers the film.
It went from the people and then went out to the universe and then to the universe back to the people. And in their skin cells. It looked weird is what I'm saying.
There was like a wow factor. Everybody still liked it a lot, but there was that ew once you were getting in and to recognize that that's inside of all of our skin cells.
Once you get ew from 12-year-olds, you're golden. That's when Volta started taking them through design exercises that would end up being the micro to macro mural. Along the way, the students learned about plant biology, the solar system, and Vesica Pisces. That's a way to create perfect equilateral triangles by drawing circles with a compass. It's how the ancient Egyptians built the pyramids.
I don't remember.
I don't either.
I mean, I remember making them and trying to make the perfect triangles and then coloring in the triangles afterwards, but I don't remember why.
Whether or not they retain specific information about Vesica Pisces a year later, those students become, overall, better. A teacher named Jerry Jackson has the data to back that up. He works at Grover Washington Middle School, which does not have a class period set aside for art. Ben Volta was hired by Grover Washington to come in once a week and create an art project during math class. So that weekly session was not strictly math, not strictly art, but a hybrid of the two. Volta and Jackson did this for 6 years.
You know, we would compare the data at the end of the year for the class that completed the project to the other classes. They got the exact same instruction that all the classes did, but once a week, my homeroom class worked on the art project, and we saw that their PSSA results were always significantly higher.
Class, if I could have your attention, we are running out of time. Some of you are a little distracted.
Volta's current project at the Russell Byers Charter School in Center City